When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. In ancient times, hanging gardens, great pyramids, and other superstructures were celebrated as wonders of the world. And like Days of the Week and Deadly Sins, there were always seven of them. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? That's the question I ask my guests in this podcast. And on stage here today, and the guest I'm asking today, is the much-admired young stand-up comedian, writer, and broadcaster, Glenn Moore. So,
Glenn, well, good. Do sit down.
Now, if we can all just fiddle around. Thank you for...
Sure.
So that's right, you've been Edinburgh before, haven't you? You've got some very good reviews and reactions.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say. Yeah, this is... last year would have been full-length show number 5. And so this is exactly just the same show this year. And just another similarly cumbersomely titled...
Yeah, you like funny titles, don't you?
What's your agonising titles, yeah.
Yeah, what's your title this year's show?
This one is Will You Still Need Me, Will You Still Feed Me, Glenn, I'm 60 More.
Yes.
Which I'm partly back at the fringe this year because this is the first year I've been able to fully pronounce it. I kept getting it wrong last year. Every time I was interviewed over it, everyone would call it When I'm 60 More or Glenn, I'm 64. And finally, this is the first time that it's actually sort of, you know...
Did you go to the sort of Joe Lycett school of show titles? He likes those sort of complicated...
Yeah, it's always fun to sort of rinse your name. So my first show was Glengarry Glen Glen, which I regret that one. And then Love Don't Live Here Glennie Moore. Glen Glen Glen, How Do You Like It? How Do You Like It? The Very Best of Belinda Carlisle. That was an outlier. And nor was Belinda mentioned at any point in the show. But she did threaten legal action.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Because Joe has done That's the Way, Joe Lycett.
Yeah, it's which perfect. Joe's excellent at those. Yeah,
so you should do double builds with these.
Yeah, I'm going to come back next to you with Please, Sir Glenn, I Have Some More, maybe.
But it's already in itself just Glenn Moore. It's a good Scottish title. It's like all those Hollywood stars.
Oh, yeah. My name is just Field Field.
Yes, yeah. Well, Glenn's a valley, isn't it? So that's,
Valley Field. Bit like Sally Fields from Forrest Gump.
Well, I was thinking you'd go along with Ben Affleck and Glenn Tilbrook, Glenn Campbell. They all sound good as names, but also they're sort of geographical tour of the Highlands.
They are. There's loads of hotels. There is a location called Glenmore, but there's loads of... I live near a Glenmore Avenue, which is really weird for me. And there's plenty of... Like, I remember being in Sydney in Australia and going past the Glenmore Hotel and stuff like that. Yeah. They're all places I cannot afford to stay in or visit, which hurts.
And is it right your full name is actually Glenn Roger Moore?
It is indeed. My dad is called... That's called Roger Moore, which is fine for my dad.
I didn't know that.
That's fine for my dad, because my dad was born before Roger Moore was really famous.
Yes.
What they did to me was an act of malice and cruelty, knowing full well that he was famous by that point. You know, it's not Glenn George Lazenby, but it's still not ideal.
Yeah, and Roger Moore, it's not such a name as a boast, isn't it? So now as I said to Roger Moore once, but anyway, so... So anyway, so you've got your seven wonders kindly sorted out. An interesting range, if I may say so. Can't quite determine where we're going with all of them. But the first one is a comedy classic, or at least it's regarded as a comedy classic on the continent.
Yes, a comedy classic that isn't in any way regarded here. I'm just going to throw this one to the audience. Is anyone here familiar with Dinner for One? So maybe about 5 or 6 of you. I'd never heard of Dinner for One or anything like that. And then about 10 years ago, at university, I lived with a German housemate of mine, and we were going to spend New Year's Eve together, a big group of us, and she was like, and we're going to watch Dinner for One, yeah? And we didn't know what Dinner for One was.
Right.
And she was like, how have you guys never heard of Dinner for One? It's English and it's a comedy. And we were like, never heard of it. And she put it on, and it was one of the most astonishing things I've ever seen. Now, I'd never heard of it before. It's from about 1963, and it looks older than the 60s. It looks like early sort of silent movies. It looks like the first episodes of Coronation Street, where you can just about make out that there are people on screen. And the idea is there's a very wealthy aristocratic woman who's at dinner, and it's a big dinner table with six dinner placings, but they're all empty. There's no one else there. And her butler is going around the table and serving the individual courses for these non-existent guests. And it gradually becomes apparent that these guests are people who have died over the years. And to keep this frail old woman happy, the butler is impersonating each of the guests. So each time he sort of goes, oh, the Duke of Gloucester, him, and he puts on a helmet or whatever, that sort of thing. And there's a recurring joke that he, you know, every time he walks past this tiger rug, he keeps tripping over the tiger's head. But because each time he serves someone dinner, he has to take a toast from a drink, so he's getting increasingly wasted throughout. And so at the end of each round, she goes, same as last year, and he goes, same as every year, dear. And that's a sort of like recurring joke. Yeah. It is, by all accounts, shit. It is one of the worst things of it. It is so lacking in humor and comedy. And the 60s were just this goldmine of excellent stuff. Even the 50s were, but it seemed completely at odds.
Well, it came from well before then. It was written.
It was a stage production, wasn't it? Yeah. And for some reason, Germany were just like, we need this. And they know comedy when they see it. And so they took it on board.
Yeah.
And since then, it's this staple of New Year's Eve TV viewing. In Germany, it's one of the most watched things of all time. It's on in Germany and Holland. Inexplicably, I think it's sometimes watched in Australia. But it's this big thing on New Year's Eve across Europe, which makes no sense to me. And it wasn't broadcast on TV in the UK until, I think, 2018. And it makes no sense. But what was weird was I was like, why is this such a big thing? And she'd be crying with laughter at these non-jokes and just losing her mind and saying, well, yeah, we all watch it. They all watch it in English, by the way. It's not subtitled or translated. They watch it fully in English.
But it's largely a silent comedy anyway.
It is mostly. It's vaguely Mr. Bean-esque, and there's only a few lines of dialogue, and it's all about the sort of physical comedy. But it's very sort of basic, but it's this big sort of family get-together, like people watching The Snowman or The Great Escape in the UK.
Yeah.
But what was strange was I was like, but you're not a fan of, like, if you like that, then you've got to see stuff like Fawlty Towers. And she was like, what is that? And it was like having a housemate who's like obsessed with the sitcom Joey, but has never heard of Friends.
Yes.
It was really surreal. Yeah. And I'm just fascinated how something, it's very strange to see something that's British just take over an entire sort of continent, but have in no way just have any sort of real sort of takeoff in the UK. It's like someone being big in Japan, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but so there are, you know, music acts are like that. But there's like Freddie Frinton, who's the star in it. His career was largely this sketch. I can vaguely remember he was an old comedian. His act was always being a drunk, although he didn't drink himself. That was his. And so when you said you were selecting this, I sort of looked him up. I thought, oh, yeah, he was quite a well-known comedian. He wasn't. But the description of his career is, well, he started doing this sketch in about 1945, and he had to buy it in there because he didn't even write it. Somebody else had created it.
Oh, my God.
And then he had to buy it from them, which was a clever thing for him done because he got sort of then got royalties from it.
Yeah.
And probably the Wikipedia or something write-up would sort of say, well, he didn't have much of a career outside that. But I thought he must have had,
But I suppose if that just kept him in work, you know, just the royalties as coming in from that. I mean, I'm not saying comedy was sort of easier in the 50s and early 60s, but I find it infuriating. I'd have to write a new hour of stand-up every single year, and he was living off that.
Well, I was going to ask you that because in the olden days, musical vaudeville, people had a sketch or 10 minutes and they were booked to do that 10 minutes. And not only did they not have to write anything else, they were told not to because that's what they wanted to see. But as you're explaining, you're having to do, and all the other comedians tend to have to do another lot each year.
But I guess that's quite an international sort of thing. I was just for laughs in Montreal last week, and all the American acts, they have their act, and their act is 6 minutes, and they hone that for a decade. Yeah. And when you tell them that you have an hour of material, they're like, oh my God. And you're like, well, yeah, it's not good, but it's like, it's, I can talk for an hour. Yes. They're just stunned by it.
Yes, yeah. Well, that's odd, that just for laughs thing. I went there years and years ago, and the Americans are much more sort of professional about things.
It's very professional. I really hope I'm not speaking out of turn. And
I hope you are.
Yeah. So just to give an indicator, this was not indicative of the rest of the festival. But what happened was I arrived at the airport and they have someone there. I've never had this before. They have like someone of a sign sort of, you know, sort of saying, are you here for the festival? And they sort of then escort you to your hotel. And so I arrived and they were sort of like, right, we're just waiting for the taxi. And someone else will be joining in a moment. They're just getting off the plane. And this American woman came over and I assumed she was one of the other acts. And I stuck up my hand and said, hi, I'm Glenn Moore. And she went, whatever. And turned back to the other person. And I was like, how have I messed up that interaction? Yeah. Like, what have I done wrong? And so I was sat in the back of a cab thinking, do I speak? Do I not speak? Mm. And eventually the cab driver said to me, he said, you're going to this hotel, aren't you? And it's a hotel where all the performers are booked into. And as soon as she heard I was at the performers hotel, she went, you're a performer? And I said, yeah. And she then stuck her hand really angry at me. And she shook my hand and she went, I'm such and such a person from such and such a media. You're going to want to get on our good side next time.
Wow.
And that was my first indication of what the scene is over there. Now, no one else was like that, but what a first impression.
Well, that's all I was going to say is that when I went there, all the American comedians would arrive with their agent or their manager or their publicist, and there would be tickets allocated for that sort of thing. All the British comedians, without exception, arrived with their girlfriend or their mother or their brother or something. Just, oh, we've got a free trip to Canada.
The same. And that's exactly what I did. I brought your mother. But I overheard two American acts. One was about to go into McDonald's and the other one was like, it's not a good look getting McDonald's here. Yeah. The industry won't like it. And it was like, what are you talking about?
All right, so dinner for one.
Yeah.
You make it a wonder of the world, though you weren't impressed by it.
No, fascinated. I'm fascinated by stuff I don't understand. For me, that's the 1960s equivalent of TikTok. I'm aware it's huge. I have no idea how to penetrate it.
I think it is. It's earlier than the 60s. I know it was filmed in the 60s.
But it's a lot earlier.
I agree with you. When you look at it, you think, oh, I hope this is really good. But it's nothing like watching an old bit of Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton or something.
No,
suddenly, because he trips over the rug in a very clumsy way every time he goes past, and there's an odd thing where he has to give an extra bit of drink to one of the guests because he always but that's the first one he served. That shouldn't be the first one. It should be the last one he serves or the halfway.
Yeah, but I want to rewrite it. The timing's all off, and it's really, really strange in that regard. And it's just, it has these lengthy pauses that reminded me of watching like a sort of Fritz Lang film from like the 30s, where they really need to hammer home what, you know, there's people like tapping their watches when they're impatient and stuff like that, or they'll zoom in on a clock that says 3 o'clock for like 11 minutes so you know what the time is. It's so strange.
And it's got a slightly unbelievable but salacious ending as well.
The ending is horrible. Yes. I think it's quite creepy. Basically, she's then tired and she sort of retires to her. She goes, I need to retire to my chambers. And he sort of goes, okay. And she goes, same ritual as last year. And he goes, same as every year, and sort of winks at the camera because they're going to fuck. It's so surreal.
Yes.
And really at odds with the rest.
It's spelled out in that way.
You're
very much of your time.
Yeah, it's not one of those things where they mouth it and then the silent movie dialogue comes on at the end. It's not like that.
The implication is a very old woman.
The implication is
that. And a completely drunk butler is somehow going to go through the usual procedure.
Yeah, and it's perfect for German children, yeah.
Anyway, I don't know. Maybe your German friend wouldn't see the point of The Great Escape as an alternative, but wouldn't have quite the same.
Yeah, she's rooting for the wrong people. Yeah. When they get captured at the end, she's like, good, they did it, they did it.
It's a great motorbike, though. You'll like that. Okay. This is not standing up at all well. This
happens to one in three men, apparently. It's fine. Yes.
It's never happened to me before. I can look at that. Okay, maybe I'll hold it.
Fine.
Does that help? So you're next.
Yes.
You're next.
I can get mine out as well if that would
be. No, don't get yours out. I think it makes it worse. Your next wonder, if you can speak for 3 minutes while I'm fixing this, is a ride at Alton Towers, Nemesis.
It's Nemesis, yeah. I think it's a one. For me, this is the only one that's like a real childhood wonder of mine. For me, it was the greatest geographical site I'd sort of ever seen in my life. I went to Alton Towers when I was about 5 years old. I'd never seen a work of engineering just so great. And when I was five, I was too short to go on Nemesis. And when I was growing up, there were two rides I really wanted to go on. Ramesses Revenge at Chessington Model of Adventures and Nemesis Alton Towers. And I liked how terrifying Nemesis was. As you queuing up, there's like a river of blood. It's sort of like a sort of, you know, Powell themed. Right. But like, if there's like this river of sort of blood as you queue, which feels like such a strange way of marketing a roller coaster fundamentally. But I was too short to go on both of those rides. And so I finally went when I was about 20 and I got to ride on it. Now, Jessington had sold the other ride that I wanted to go on. They'd sold it to Alton Towers and I was now too tall to go on it. So I'm gutted that I never got to go on that. But Nemesis was such a big treat for me. And I remember it so vividly because it was so cathartic to finally go on this one ride I'd wanted to go on 20 years after I'd initially wanted to go on and sort of fulfill this childhood dream, albeit under the most ill circumstances I'd ever encountered. Because this was when I was at university, and to help sort of fund my way through university, I worked at this sort of silver service restaurant where I had no waitering skills whatsoever, but I had even though I'm from Croydon and not from a posh background, I have this stupid accent. And as a result, they hired me on that because they were like, well, this is a fancy restaurant and you'll sound fancy. And so I used to work at this restaurant. I couldn't afford to eat there myself. And on the final day, on my final shift, which was the day before I went to Alton Towers, they wrapped up loads of tin foiled food for me and they said, money would have been nice, but it was very nice of them. And so I took what I assumed was going to be like Chateaubriand and stuff like
your
that.
Your retirement gift was wrapped up, a doggy bag.
Yes, it was a doggy bag.
It's a classy place.
I would have loved it. I'd sampled some of the food before, not in view of the guests, but if people didn't touch half their meal, of course I would wolf it down, you know. But like if we had these sort of like saloon doors, so sometimes like the door would open, it would just be me crouched over with a bit of their chips. But people would order like 500 pound bottles of champagne and stuff, and they would take one sip and then leave. And so when the restaurant was closed, we'd be walking around the restaurant just swigging this enormous. I've learned as well, there's no difference in taste. There is no from those to the sort of cheaper ones. But I was so excited to have all this sort of food, and I took it with me to Alton Towers because I could only really just about afford as a student to go to Alton Towers. Couldn't afford to have food there. And so just before we went on Nemesis, which I was so excited to do, my friends all bought food and I unwrapped, you know, what I thought was good, and it was all quail's eggs. It was only quail's eggs that they'd sort of wrapped up. So I ate about 12, like a middle-class Cool Hand Luke, and I ate them all and then went on one of the most vigorous roller coasters. Yeah. And so it's amongst the most ill I've ever felt, but it was just, there's something about sort of finally revisiting something that you wanted to do as a child. Yeah. Is actually really, really nice. And for it not to be tragic to sort of revisit, like a roller coaster you can go on as an adult and that's not a sad thing to do. I never really got to there was like this really exciting soft play I wanted to go to when I was a kid. I now can't do that as a grown-up.
No.
No.
No, you'd look very dodgy.
No, I need a child chaperone. Yes, sort of opposite way around, yeah.
So the quail's eggs, though, was that helpful, though, in the end? Because I don't know, do you sort of lose it? Do you do you spill your guts on a thing like that? And quail's egg may hold it all in.
No, they
in
were
a
actually,
binding way.
They were actually really delicious. But it was just simply not a lunch. It was just not a lunch sort of whatsoever. And I thought I looked weird to passers-by. And occasionally passers-by would look by us and sort of be like, well, where's the quail's egg stand? May I have some for myself? Yeah.
So the whole idea of going on a roller coaster or a very exciting version of this, does that still appeal to you? Have you done it once, or do you now become obsessed by it? Because for some people, it's obvious. You want to go on and scare yourself witless. Mm. And other people look at it and say, why would you want to do that? Why do you want to queue up, pay a lot of money just to have a minute or a minute and a half of terror, and then you get a photograph of yourself screaming?
That's the only issue. Yeah. I hate how I look. I don't think I'm scared by roller coasters, but then I see the photos of myself afterwards and I look like I seek urgent medical attention.
Yes.
Really, there's like, I look like a Peter Gabriel video, just really sort of contorting. And I really do enjoy the thrill, but there's no excitement to be had queuing for upwards of an hour for just, you know, a minute of excitement. But I went to Disney World when I was about 9 years old.
Yes.
And I so want to return, but I think it would be sinister to do as an adult.
Yes. You need to...
And I'm not saying that's why I've had a child, but like it's helped.
But then you may find as you get older, you're forced to go on more and more things with your children.
I mean, do you like roller coasters?
No, I don't. I have... I used to like... Well, I still like going to the local fairs when it has a sort of wheel on it or something. And then a 13-year-old person who's operating things sort of puts in the safety catch without really looking at it. And you get real excited from that because you could easily fall
off. You could die.
But you go to Disneyland or you know...
There's no jeopardy.
They've got all their safety.
Yeah, it's like watching a Superman movie. Yeah. You know Superman's not going to die at the end. You want real risk that you and your loved ones might be seriously injured. Last year was the first time I ever went to like a traveling fun fair, because before then I was really nervous about it. Because there's something about... I don't trust a roller roller coaster that every few months has to move to a different part of the country.
Yeah, well, that's part of the joy of it, though, isn't it? And I think in a way, and I don't know, I'm not here preaching, anti-capitalism, but there's a horrible way that even things like silly rides are now corporatized so that you travel for miles and miles and miles, maybe even fly the Atlantic to go on a ride that used to be come to the end of your road or in a park near you.
Yeah.
And somebody got a reasonable income out of it, just about.
Of course.
Now people make millions out of being, you know, in charge of Disney or whatever, whichever the company. I don't know who Mr. Alton is or Mrs. Alton is who runs the...
It's Mr. Towers,
Mr.
actually,
Towers,
to you.
Yes,
yeah. But there was... I think the worst capitalist example is ones like there's Winter Wonderland in Hyde Park in London, where you don't have to pay to get in, but each of the rides is like £16 or something insane. And I remember going on a date with a girl there, and we'd gone on about say, 4 dates, and I went with her, and she just let me pay for... Yeah. Everything, and she wanted to go on every ride, every single ride, and I must have spent about £80. And then we got to the tube stop afterwards, and it was sort of that sort of stage of evening of sort of like, well, you know, you sort of your place or mine. And she went, I think we should just be friends. And it's the only time I've ever wanted to say on a date, well, can I have my money back, please?
All right. There's a certain age. You said you've got a child. I don't know how old your child is, but there's a certain age of children when they get old, they don't want you with you. And when they're very young, they're probably a bit nervous. So there's a sort of key age when they want to go on every ride, but you still have to go on it with them. And their capacity for being hurled around on things is better, more than yours. And it's a tiresome bit of parenting, I think.
Oh yeah,
that's
sure.
That's rather put me off.
Oh yeah, my child loves to be is just under 2 years old and loves to be like. This is going to sound awful. Loves to be like choke slammed into the sofa. Yes. Like he loves like wrestling moves and stuff like that. And so I was always like assured my girlfriend. I was always like, don't worry. He adores it. He comes back from what is what he wants, and I do it very safely. I know exactly what we're sort of doing. And then I'll sort of do it in sort of front of friends, and then he'll burst out crying, and you go, why? Did you, come on, man. Why are you doing this in front of me now? You love it.
Yes. When is your case being heard?
Yeah.
Oh, let's move on
sure.
rapidly from chokeholds on your children to your third wonder, which is what women want.
Yes, the Mel Gibson, Helen Hunt film.
Wait a minute, just to clear where we are, this, you've got every wonder in the world to choose from.
Yes.
And maybe you thought, well, I'll have a film section. And of all the films that have ever been made...
Then who better than the famous anti-Semite Mel Gibson?
Well, leaving that side of it aside, there's not too much of the anti-Semitism, I don't think, in the film. But it's a quirky film, isn't it? If I remember the plot correctly, due to some sort of accident with a hairdryer, he acquires the ability to know what women want, what all women want.
Yes.
Sort of telepathically or just...
Including, at one occasion, one female dog. And the film does not go on to explore that scientific marvel, which is surely of more use than wanting to know what people who can easily communicate to you want. It's a wonder to me because I didn't just want to put the concept of DVDs, but it was a wonder to me because it was the first DVD I ever saw.
Oh, I see.
And so I remember it very, very well. I went to visit my aunt and uncle who were living in St. Louis in America. And this was a month after 9/11. So everyone was very, very tense. And we were very, very nervous when we were flying. I remember we went to Chicago. We went to like the top of the CN Tower of a John Hancock building or something like that. And someone saw this pinprick of a jet in the sky. Like when you can see the and they started screaming. It was miles above us. And everyone started screaming. And it was a really, really sort of tense atmosphere. But in the evenings, they sort of... And uncle showed off the fact that they had this DVD player.
Yeah.
And we put on What Women Want, and we couldn't get over the fact that, I didn't like the film, but you couldn't get over the fact that you put it in and we didn't have to rewind it. We just had, this animated menu came up.
Yeah.
And my aunt and uncle, they put the DVD in first and they said, you know what, actually, hey, why don't we get a takeaway? And they said, we're just going to go and find the pizza menus. And they left the room. And what we experienced before we saw the DVD is what happens when you leave a DVD menu to run for longer than 5 seconds. And for upwards of half an hour, we had this looping 10-second DVD where they play a little snippet of music and it's just Mel Gibson's face flying across the screen, Helen Hunt's the other way.
Yeah.
And we had that for half an hour and it is ingrained on my memory. I think when I close my eyes, it's still there like PTSD.
Yeah.
But I've just never experienced anything like that. And I know that it's obviously a phenomenon that's since sort of long gone and it probably wasn't as exciting as the first time anyone had their own VHS player or anything like that. But my God, that's still the most few... That blew me away more than, say, the first time I used an iPhone.
Yes.
Blew me away. The first time I've tried on a VR headset or something like that.
But it's interesting. Now you're rattling through all those various bits of technology, which have all come and gone. And now, I don't know if there are any young people in the audience. I'm sure there are lots of you very, very young. Not all of you, obviously. But they're almost like, well, what's a DVD? We don't, you know, don't even use it. VHS, what's he on about now? We just rattled through so many different technologies in recent years. Nothing seems to hang around for much longer than it needs to.
No, not at all. I remember VHSs being there for about maybe sort of 10 years of my life. And the second DVDs arrived, it was like, well, you know, saying goodbye to those. Yeah. But I just, I mean, I haven't purchased a DVD in yet. Do you know what? Actually, I was doing a filming a sort of TV recording last week and I needed to hold a DVD. And I realized when I got to Edinburgh, the only DVD I have in my home, which is A Muppet's Christmas Carol, which belongs to my girlfriend and has done for years, yes. I'd forgotten to bring it. It is so hard to buy a DVD on the fly. There's one HMV in Edinburgh on Princes Street. And now the DVDs are relegated to like the basement bit, like a real sort of like you're going into some sort of porn dungeon. Yeah. It's really strange. You sort of say you want a DVD and they're like, oh, do you?
Yes.
We've got a weird customer.
Yeah. And if you're here temporarily, you might have to go and buy a DVD player.
We'd have to buy a DVD player. Yeah, How we go about doing that? I don't even know. My laptop doesn't even have a disc drive. I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah.
Well, you can buy them to plug in, but I bought it in order to watch a DVD I had to watch for something. But I haven't used it since. So
no, not at all.
I mean, that's £20 I'm not going to get back. You know? So what women want on the basis that you saw it on a DVD?
Just because it was the first film I ever saw. So whatever would have been the first film I ever saw on a DVD player would have been my favourite.
Yeah.
And for me, it was What Women Want. For my sister, it was the next night. She watched Final Destination, the plane crash film, the day before we flew home, a month after 9/11. One of the worst decisions I've ever known anyone to make.
are you interested in film? Are you an actor as well as a comedian, would you say? Would you like to be Mel Gibson in the movie?
Yeah, no, I wanted to be a movie. That was like the childhood ambition I had that came about from when I was born to when I was about 5 years old. And I remember so vividly watching Home Alone when I was 5 years old and seeing Macaulay Culkin and being like, that is what I want to be when I'm older. And I said to my mum straight afterwards, I said, when I grow up, I want to be a movie star.
Yeah.
And my mum was like, well, to be a movie star like Macaulay Culkin, you would have had to have needed to have been in TV shows and adverts when you were like sort of 2 and 3 years old and stuff like that. So I got told at the age of 5, I'd left my life ambition too late.
That's a bit cruel of your mother.
Yeah,
right?
I was in like sort of like a children's Amdram and stuff like that when I was growing up, sort of like Saturday sort of groups where you sort of like rehearse a show and then eventually perform it to say 100, you know, parents. And I really enjoyed doing that. And the person who ran it, she was friends of a casting director who was like, you look like Harry Potter and they're making a film of Harry Potter and I can get you an audition. And she'd see me before, and so I was sort of lined up to sort of have this audition, but we had to sort of submit a headshot first officially. And it's really it's easy now doing a headshot, you just use your phone and it's fine. Back then we had to sort of use my dad's like disposable camera, take 100 other shots of other things around the house. And my parents had this insistence that they knew better than I did what Harry Potter was, and I'd read at this point only about 2 of the Harry Potter books were out, but at this point I'd read them, I knew what they're about. And my mum, I think for some reason, had decided the front cover of the Philosopher's Stone was famously Harry Potter in a school uniform and there's an old steam train of the Hogwarts Express. My mum saw that and decided the book is set in Victorian times. Harry Potter's a Victorian. And so I said, well, he's a wizard. And she went, no, he's not. And I said, no, I've read the books. And she went, no, he's like a chimney sweep or something like that. And so my parents dressed me up with like a flat. This is for the acting headshot. They were like, you need to look like Harry Potter. They put this flat cap on me and they put like coal on my face. The fact that I then after that was like had an audition sort of lined up after that is astonishing. The audition never actually ended up happening. We had to go on holiday and postpone it. And then they cast Daniel Radcliffe in that time.
So you didn't get the part. Let me just...
to make that clear.
It sounds like your mother was deliberately sabotaging your career.
It sounds like a very... To insist to me that Harry Potter's a chimney sweep and to gaslight me into thinking I'd read 2 whole books wrong is wild.
Yeah. So how did you get into comedy? Was that something you developed separate from all that, or did it...
It was completely accidentally. I loved to attempt to make people laugh in conversation, but that was never sort of a skill or an affinity I really sort of had. But it was just a nice feeling if ever you were successful in making someone laugh. But I was at university, and at the University of Sheffield, we used to host this this sort of student comedy festival where it would be sort of like the big headliners on a Saturday night were like the Cambridge Footlights, and they'd play the big venue, and it felt like a real sort of like Glastonbury-esque thing. And then you'd have like the Leeds Tea Lights, Bristol Reunions, and all the other sort of sketch groups, and it was just really, really well thought out and well put together. And they had a few open mic nights scattered across the course of the weekend. And there was one time I was helping run the festival. I was involved in student plays, but in no way in comedy. But some friends of mine were helping run the festival. And there was one open mic night where they said, look, the guy's meant to be hosting. He's stuck on the motorway. Glenn, if we give you like 10 minutes, can you go backstage and just try and write some material? And then just host the gig. So my first gig was with 10 minutes notice and only in front of about 8 people or so, but I was forced into it. I was forced into comedy.
So it went well enough for you to give you the taste for doing it.
Yes, even though the circumstances in which it happened were what most people would consider a stress dream.
Yeah.
Like that's what you would have a nightmare where you wake up and you are given 10 minutes to write stand-up. That's the sort of thing you'd have a nightmare about. And so that was the sort of way it started. And then my friends entered me. Again, this sounds like pure malice on the part of my friends. There's a student comedy competition called the Chortle Student Comedy Awards. And so my friends signed me up for that without telling me, knowing that it was something I wanted to do, but I didn't want to be seen as having this sheer gall, the sheer arrogance of going, I'm going to give comedy a go. Yeah. So they did it for me and then it just sort of started from there.
So basically your life sounds like your mother pulling you away from show business and your friends,
my friends
forcing you into it. And it's worked out well. So you do stand up crime, but you also do you read the news. I used to read the news.
Yeah. So that was my first job. I it was strange. I'd gone after the Home Alone debacle. My parents. I was like, you know what? Yeah, you're right. Acting is a frivolous thing that might never sort of take off or anything like that. And so I thought, you know what? I really, for some reason, at the age of five, wanted to be a newsreader, which is an insane thing for a child to want to do. But I just really liked the idea of it. And so
it was a steadier, safer sort of career.
Exactly. And still getting to
broadcast. Occasionally does, but
and still getting to sort of broadcast and you know, and I thought that'd be sort of quite fun. And so I did English Lit at university, knowing that I'd hopefully be able to go on to do a master's in journalism. And so did, and then trained up as a journalist and then got a job as like a roving reporter in Sheffield and sort of did that for a couple of years. In that time, I'd done my first couple of gigs. And so suddenly, having gone my entire life thinking, I want to be a newsreader, I'd done a couple of gigs and thought, this is way more fun. This is way better. And so it was difficult I sort of juggled the two for a few years. And I wouldn't tell my news editor that I was sneaking off to do gigs at night and stuff like that because I thought she would think I was deeply unserious.
Well, that's handy for doing topical comedy because you were reading the news during the day or during the newsreader bit, getting all the stories in your head ready to come up with jokes.
Well, the only problem was I wasn't doing topical stuff at all. Oh, well. So then, in fact, the only actual time the news sort of bled into it was occasionally if I was nervous at a gig, I'd maybe have a drink beforehand. I would get drunk and then I would spill news stories that hadn't come out yet on stage. So I'd go on stage and be like, apparently Rolf Harris is getting arrested in a few days. And then think, what have I done? That was something I did. I did that.
Did you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it came as a shock to all of us, I must say. Rolf Harris.
Yeah.
Of all the stories. Oh, well, no, not of all of them. But anyway, there have been more shocking ones since.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let's move on to your fourth wonder.
Sure.
We made the Swiss Glockenspiel in Leicester Square.
Yes, do you know it?
I do. I know Leicester Square pretty well.
Above Eminem's world, don't you?
I don't, but I've had unhappy memories of Leicester Square when I think they were building the Swiss Centre. I'm not playing into stereotypes, but I had quite a bad accident involving damage to my teeth, and though I need them fixed, and my father, who was Scottish, found that there was a dental hospital in Leicester Square where you could get it done on the National Health, which you couldn't get it done anywhere else. So for me, Leicester Square is a place of horror, but they built there was a Swiss centre, which is no longer there, but they've reinstated the Glockenspiel.
They've reinstated the Glockenspiel, and there's no context. There's no real sort of easy to read signage sort of around or anything like that. But I have this, I don't know, this fixation, this fascination by Leicester Square. When I was a child, I really thought it was like the place to be in London. And I thought it's where all the celebrities lived. Because yes. Where else would you want to go? The cinema's there. TGI Fridays is there. Yeah. You've got all your amenities. You can do the big shop at M&M's World each week. And so I just loved it. And so as a child, it was like where I wanted to hang out and where I wanted to sort of spend my time. And I dreamt of one day living in Leicester Square.
Well, there are ways of doing that, but it's... Yeah. I mean, it's a famous square.
If you're willing to lie on a bench and look at the Mr. Bean statue, you can. But I did end up briefly living in Leicester Square because
it's a little bit shabby as a...
It's very shabby. And I learned that as an adult. But when I was a newsreader, I was like a freelance newsreader at LBC, and there that is obviously based in Leicester Square,
right? Yeah.
And so what would happen is I'd get back from gigs, I'd do like a gig in Cardiff at Cardiff Jonglers, get off stage at 10 p.m, get on the megabus, arrive back in London at 3 a.m. and think, well, I start reading the news at 5 a.m, so I'll just sleep on the sofa there for 2 hours. And so it was awful. I did that for a couple of years, and then because it was LBC and I was a freelance newsreader, it meant you're putting all the shifts people don't want, so you put on like the early breakfast shift, the weekend shift, that sort of thing. And sometimes it dictated which presenter you were reading the news for. So I was the newsreader for Katie Hopkins and Nigel Farage.
Oh, right. Did you have to adjust the news a bit?
I did not enjoy. Let's just never meet your heroes. Okay, I hated working with them. It was bizarre because they would obviously do their own shows and say whatever. But then obviously, because of Ofcom's broadcasting guidelines, you just then had to do sort of objectively read the news. But I would just have this permanent sense of dread. But I would go to Leicester Square and I would just stand at the sort of third story window and just look out at all these people sort of vomiting their Friday nights out all over the sort of pavement. And the sound of that fucking Glockenspiel then became this sort of burden, this albatross around my neck that would signal, oh, you're about to get 2 hours sleep because you've arrived in Leicester Square. So what became actually this what I thought was just this really nice little sort of monument, this just quirky little bit of London, actually ended up becoming something I absolutely despise. But it seems so out of place in somewhere like Leicester Square.
Your decisions on what the wonders of the world are
they're mostly things I hate
from anybody else.
Clive, okay. Don't get me started on the pyramids.
So it's for you, it's arriving back late at night. Actually, you had quite a long period of overlap between stand-up comedy and news reading, which is an unusual one.
Partly because news reading wasn't really as financially lucrative as I assumed it would be, because I thought, well, by the nature of broadcasting to millions of people, surely that comes with you get a pound per listener or something that you don't. And so I wasn't really earning enough that way. And then comedy was, I was only able to really sort of work on weekends, and I was trying to juggle the two sort of together.
So two half jobs.
Two half jobs. And then I quit in 2017 was the last time I did a full news reading shift. And that was the night before the first episode I ever did of Mock the Week. I thought I should feel comfortable enough in comedy that I can leave that side of my life behind. I should feel comfortable enough now by doing it. And so that kind of felt okay. And also by that point, Katie Hopkins and Nigel Farage were still there, and it was just starting to become a real sort of burden, because you're obviously, when your friends, people that you talk to obviously find it very easy to live your life on your behalf. So they're like, if it was me, I'd simply tell them what I thought of them and just walk out that building. And it's like, okay, enjoy not having a job there. Like, obviously you can't do that.
No, I think I wouldn't go on about it too much. You may fear your bank debanking you if you're too close to Nigel Farage. But anyway, so that's the Glockenspiel.
It's a Glockenspiel.
Those two lives.
Yes.
Back. And do you go back for old time's sake and look at it and? It's like a clock, isn't it?
I think it sort of kind of rotates and it plays this really like jangling, like really grating sort of noise, but it does sort of ring out and it echoes out across the whole of Leicester Square.
Yeah.
So if you're on one corner of it, you don't know where that sound is coming from. So it's really strange. And for a location, it is sort of quite, it's very sort of mainstreamy. And as I said, you know, there's a Mr. Bean statue. It's where all the movie premieres are. Yeah. It's where all those sort of glossy restaurants are, you know, the Chiquitos and Pizza Hut and stuff like that, and a big McDonald's. It does seem strange that there's this little cultural signpost there.
Well, it used to be the Swiss Center, and it had Swiss restaurants and Swiss products and all sorts of things. But that makes not much more sense either.
Why? No, it doesn't, because why was there one? Yeah. You know, and it almost feels like one of, it feels like a straight, you know how like the Statue of Liberty is just this huge imposition of a gift from France, but it feels like it's a strange gift from Switzerland. It's really, really strange. We don't have anything like that in the UK. You know, we don't have like an Emmerdale signpost in Bern.
No. Well, maybe we do.
Yeah.
All right. So the Swiss clock and
strip. Yes.
Now, a slight change of mood. Virgil's Aeneid.
Yes. That was a wonder to me because it absolutely got me through a university degree, because I studied it at school and that wasn't really on much of the curriculum. And of the two sort of like, I'd say the two biggest ancient texts from around that time are probably like Homer's, well, out of the three, it's like Homer's Odyssey, yeah, the Iliad, and then the Aeneid, I think.
Yes.
Of the two, of the main sort of three.
But and probably of those three, the least referenced in...
It's the least referenced, yeah, and it's a good one. It's a banger, and it's from, and it's kind of seen from the opposite perspective of the Iliad, which kind of makes it...
Greece with Italy.
Exactly.
Or with Rome, rather.
Right? Yeah, and it's got, and even like reading it as like a 17-year-old who only really cared about, you know, sort of like The Matrix and Black Hawk Down and stuff like that, there are like some cool, it's like quite cinematic, and there's quite some sort of cool moments. There's like a bit where there's one particular sort of soldier, and you know, he sort of slays a few other soldiers, and he goes back to his sort of friends, and he sort of goes, guys, that was great, we slew a and then he realizes he's with the wrong people, he's with the enemy, and so they just kill him. And you go, oh, that's the sort of thing you'd get in a really trashy,
yeah,
like Bond film or something like that. But what was handy was I really sat down and listened to it and really enjoyed it at school.
So you were studying, you did English at university. Was this part of a classics course?
Not at all. Latin, no. English, it was just part of, it was literature, part of English. Yeah. And it's not really on the curriculum, so I don't know why it was sort of part of that.
You read it in English rather than
We
Latin?
Read it in English, yes, yeah. I wouldn't have been able to sort of do it otherwise. Then when I went to uni, it was perfect because everyone was using these sort of quite, not generic English literature texts, but everyone would sort of have their go-to text that they knew like the back of their hand. So when it came to discussing a work of Charles Dickens, they'd sort of go, oh, that reminds me of reminds me of Mary Shelley, actually. Yeah. And they'd quote that every single week. Yeah. And so for me, it was the Aeneid, because none of the lecturers had read it either. So I could say whatever I wanted. I feel reluctant actually memorizing bits, or like trying to recall bits of the Aeneid, because I've made so much of it up to twist a point in my favor in an English literature degree. Yeah. I fully think the fact that I graduated was down to that text. Right.
Well, you make it up as far as I'm concerned. I know it starts with sort of the Troy story, but then it explains the founding of Rome, which I thought came from Romulus and Remus being suckled
on
but they are descended from the character in this story.
Yeah, and it's a bit more grounded, and it's made a bit more sort of humanized, and it's quite a strange one. I don't know if he like died during the writing of it, but the whole thing is that you sort of, the whole message of it is sort of like you're meant to sort of give mercy to the people that you've sort of bested. If you bested someone in combat and they're not dead, then the idea is you just go, okay, well, I've won, we've accepted I've won. And so at the end, he sort of bests, sorry about the spoilers, but you have had thousands of years. But he finally bests his sort of opponent. And, you know, and he sort of goes, right, I've vanquished him, this is it, we're going to leave it there. And his opponent's like, okay, he got his hands up. And he realizes his opponent is now wearing a necklace as a trophy of one of his friends who he'd obviously killed. And he goes, oh, fuck you, and he just stabs him and then it ends. And that completely undermines the whole message of it. It was surreal. He must have died mid-sentence.
All right. You think there was more to come from Virgil?
There was more to come. It could have ended like that. It's bizarre.
Yeah. Well, a lot of books are like that.
I guess Canterbury Tales. Exactly. It's very fairy tale.
He stupidly says how many tales he's going to write.
You're right.
Doesn't write them.
It's kind of that fairy tale logic where they always sort of go, and it was all about the pauper, and the pauper hopes you marry a prince, and at the end she goes, she married a prince and she was rich. And Jerry Maguire, the movie, that does that as well, where it's sort of like the whole moral throughout is sort of like, look, he was this big sports agent, he lost everything, but he learned love along the way. And at the end it's like, but he became a millionaire, so it's fine. Bye. So it kind of reminded me of that. But it's an amazing tale. The version I've made up in my head is an amazing text, and so as a result, that got me through so much of my life.
Okay, all right. Well, that's a genuine wonder of literature, I should imagine. So that makes it onto your list.
Wait, have I read something you haven't read?
Oh, absolutely.
There's plenty
I haven't read.
Oh, I've never felt clever in my life. Yeah. Okay, this feels good. Yeah.
But I have read the Wikipedia entry on it, ready for this conversation, which hasn't helped me that much.
Yeah.
Your sixth wonder is London Zoo.
London Zoo. Again, it's one of those things that I never got to visit as a child, then got to visit as an adult. The current radio show that I work on Absolute Radio, because it is in central London and we're done at 10 a.m., I was just finding my commute home involved me walking through Regent's Park. So one day is this creepy? I went to London Zoo on my own.
Well, it's not creepy, but it's most people are there with children or groups or something like that.
Yeah, they are. So I felt creepy. I didn't want to feel creepy, but I felt, I did, but it was just excellent. I think it is so surreal just having because obviously if you pay entry, then it's obviously a surreal experience anyway. But it's a surreal experience even if you just walk around it. For some reason, where the giraffes are, that's not a bit you have to pay to go to. Yeah. So my walk home every single day, Monday to Friday, involves going past London Zoo, and it means going past the giraffes bit. And it's very strange to live in London, but I walk past giraffes every day.
Yeah,
and I really like that. And so for me, that is a wonder, because it feels like they can't be well. They can't be well animals because of the general sort of congestion and pollution, but it's really nice.
Well, luckily their heads are above most of the pollution. That's an evolutionary advantage they have.
The only weird thing about London Zoo is it hasn't got the best animal. It hasn't got, like, a lot of the time it sort of goes, hey, do you like chimpanzees? Hey, do you like elephants? And you go, yeah. And they go, well, step right this way to Whipsnade Zoo, which is just 20 miles in that direction. They keep advertising this other zoo, but it's the giraffes bit of it. It brightens my day every single morning.
Well, I think the feeling has kind of moved a bit against zoos, hasn't it? They were a big attraction in Victorian times and right up until two or three decades ago. But now people think it's not fair to keep large animals. So London Zoo has got its country this department at Whipsnade. So all those big animals are there. But there are lots of zoos around the country, but some of them, I think, has Glasgow Zoo just closed? Is anyone from Glasgow? Decades ago, was it? Oh, surely not. Surely. All right. Well, either decades ago, or you sound as though you know more about it than I do.
I disagree with zoos as a concept, and I think they will eventually die out, because I think people find it easier to travel across the world now in general to be able to see something you might want to see, or also just the fact that we have easy access to video footage. You could watch a live stream from like a chimpanzee sanctuary and see that surely fulfills what you otherwise sort of wouldn't get. And I'm against that sort of as an idea. And I was in Copenhagen a while back and went to the zoo there, and that zoo is astonishing because they've got, it's just banger after banger. There's no crap animals. It's just the good ones.
Yes.
But they're all opposite. Like, the elephants are opposite the polar bears. And you go, this isn't... I shouldn't be able to see both of them in the same field of vision.
Yeah. Sounds like it's more zoos than just London Zoo. You've been to lots of them.
Only those two. I haven't been to other zoos. Okay. I haven't been to sort of many other zoos. Yeah.
Well, there's one here in Edinburgh, unless it closed down decades ago as well.
But it's purely just based on that. I probably should have been more specific and just been like, specifically those two giraffes. It's those two giraffes that are, to me, a wonder, because it's so completely at odds with the rest of my experience of, I walk from the BT Tower to there and then back to, I mean, to sort of to Kilburn. Just makes no sense. It makes no sense to me. Yeah. I love it.
And is are animals an interest of yours, or is it just...
No. Never had like pets growing up or anything like that.
No.
My parents have got a couple of pet dogs since me and my sister sort of left home.
They're replacements.
They're definitely replacements, because they're children who never grow up. When I go back, the floor is strewn with toys and stuff like that. And obviously I got rid of mine when I was 18. And it's all very sort of childlike. When it's Christmas and stuff like that, my parents will hand me a Christmas card that signed from the dogs.
Yes.
But they write it with their left hand, so it's messy handwriting.
All right.
As if to go, well, let's not be far-fetched.
Yes.
But dogs wouldn't be able to write well, would they?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very... it's cute, but it's insane.
Well, surely they draw a little, paw thing on it with the central paw and then...
They don't even do that. It's like written... Yeah. They spell it right as well. Yeah, it's really... Yeah. I do this with... I send... When I sort of give people Christmas cards, what I do is it's quite... Because it's me, my girlfriend, and then the baby. You sort of do that thing where you sort of write your name and your girlfriend's name, and then with the baby's name you do it like really scrawled as if it's, you know, sort of messy. But what I do is I write my name and the baby's name normally, and I do a scrawl for my girlfriend's name. She has never laughed once, and I find it so funny to do.
Well, I'm not going to laugh at your parents for treatment of dogs. I won't go into that. So anyway, so London Zoo, we're on to your final your final wonder, which is, again, it's a puzzling one, but no doubt you can explain it. In-flight entertainment, especially the television programming on aeroplanes.
Yes, I think it's a wonder. I want to... I'm not a drug user, Clive.
No.
But I want... The only drugs I want to try are the drugs used by the people who choose what TV shows...
Okay.
Are on planes. And right. I find it such a... I cannot wait for any long-haul flight, because I cannot wait to see the insane choices that they have, where they go, welcome to be... Here's a randomly chosen episode from series 4 of Scrubs.
Yes.
And you go, okay. And you watch that, and then they go, did you like that? Well, there's none more where that came from. Here's the season finale of Desperate Housewives, and you better believe it's a second part of a two-parter. That sort of thing for me is excellent. And it that I find very entertaining. But it brings back a memory of when I was about 13 years old and the hardest I've ever laughed in my life, which is something I remember so very vividly, that at the time I'd watched a lot of comedy by the time I was 13 and was already a bit sort of jaded by it and couldn't find myself to laugh. And Arrested Development, they had one episode of Arrested Development. It was season 2, so not an easy way to get into the show. And it was an episode where, if you're familiar with the show, Tobias was trying to get closer to his daughter by dressing up as an English nanny called Mrs. Featherbottom in what was essentially a complete replay of Mrs. Doubtfire. And at one point he tries to enchant his daughter by floating down from the top of a balcony with his umbrella, and obviously just falls a full story through a coffee table. And it's the hardest I've ever laughed at anything on this 24-hour flight back from Australia. So I may have been giddy, but what I found it so funny, I went to rewind the episode, but it just restarted the episode from the beginning. And this moment comes about 17 minutes in. So I happily just rewatched that 17 minutes again, got to the bit, laughed just as hard. It was a night flight as well. I woke up so many passengers with my laughter. Yeah. And it made me laugh so much, I then did it a third time. And I think I did it a fourth time. I spent an hour watching 1 second over and over and over again. But I'm so grateful for that insane, because by rights, they should have, if it was selected by normal people, they would have chosen the pilot. And I probably wouldn't have gotten into the show. But because they chose this random episode, it's still the hardest I've ever laughed at anything. And I'm so, so grateful for that.
And so those, it's the television ones you're interested in, rather than, do you watch films as well? Because it's a good place to watch a film, which is, you know, not a brilliant film, but
any film starring Jennifer Aniston or Sarah Jessica Parker, that will be on a plane. Yeah, anything like that, really generic movies.
Yeah.
I was excited to go on a flight a couple of weeks ago and see, well, what have they randomly chosen? It was the finale of The Last of Us on its own. Who's that for?
Yes.
That's only for the people who have watched all the episodes so far apart from the finale. It's so weird. I really, but I'm grateful.
Years ago, I once had a rather ludicrous job where I made little linking pieces for TV programs to be on British Airways flights. And so we recorded...
So you're like a live continuity announcer.
Yeah, they were supposed to be sort of jokes, and then it would introduce whatever the bit was.
Mm.
It was a ridiculous job because we recorded it in a sort of studio, but it was like a fashion studio. So the next door studios always had music playing while they were filming people walking around. So we had to keep going and say, please, could you turn that off while we just record this bit? You think, why don't you invest... Just find your location to record. And then we did it. And I thought, that was a really sort of, you know, hack thing to have done. But it paid dividends in the end, because I was on my way back from actually doing a TV program and I was flying on British Airways. And for some reason, I had to get in after, you know, into the window seat. Hmm. And the woman next to me was a bit grumpy with me and found me rather tiresome. And she might. And then the stewardess came along and said, oh, Mr. Anderson, they'd noticed that I was who I was. And I was doing the continuity linking. Oh, since you've done that, you must come and be upgraded to first class. And the look on that woman's face, because she didn't know who I was, but I was being upgraded to first class. And as I got out, and it was an accident, I knocked her orange juice over. So the whole thing. So That's brought back that happy memory for me.
That must be amazing. So it's great if they're sort of Darth Vader. We must send you, right. We've got your films. That's amazing.
Anyway, those are your 7 wonders.
They are indeed,
Glenn.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now I have to I have to decide what is the wonder of wonders, the wonder of all the ones that you have advocated on behalf of. I mean, it's quite a difficult decision to make in this case.
Because you don't like any of them.
Well, they're slightly unusual, I would say.
I hate a lot of them. That's what makes it weird.
Yes, I know. That's what makes your... But I think it may be rather cruel for you as your comedy career gets better and bigger and stronger and stronger. But let's go with Dinner for One.
Make perfect. That your behind the pinnacle of comedy.
And we can add to the enthusiasm for that. It might even get shown on television in this country. But anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Glenn Moore.
Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you very, very much.
If you enjoyed this episode of My Seven Wonders, it would be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you found us. Thank you for listening.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.